on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Hamas to accept a ceasefire in Cairo Monday, part of a growing international pressure to bring an end to the eight-month-old conflict with Israel. VOA's Catherine Shipson has more in efforts to end those tensions.
The United Nations Security Council overwhelmingly passed a resolution Monday endorsing the ceasefire plan. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
Palestinian civilians are living through sheer hell through no fault of their own. And the humanitarian situation in Gaza has gotten worse and worse and worse.
The ceasefire deal outlined by the United States 10 days ago would allow for the release of the remaining 120 Israeli hostages in captivity. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Reuters' Angela Johnson tells us more about the UN resolution adopted and Hamas's response.
Monday's resolution welcomes that proposal, says Israel has accepted the deal, and calls on Hamas to agree to it.
For those in favor of the draft resolution, please raise their hand.
14 Security Council members voted in favor.
Abstentions?
Russia abstained. Its ambassador asked what Israel had specifically agreed to. Hamas welcomed the adoption of the U.S.-drafted resolution. In a statement, the militant group said it's ready to cooperate with mediators over implementing the plan's principles.
That's Reuters' Angela Johnson reporting. The U.S. military said Monday that it plans to stockpile aid shipments on a secure beach in Gaza during a U.N. pause on distributing food from the American-built pier after one of the deadliest days of the Israel-Hamas war. The UN World Food Program, which works with U.S. officials to transfer desperately needed aid from the month-old pier to warehouses and local relief teams in Gaza, tweeted Monday that the UN would conduct a security review to assess. This is VOA News. A snap election called by the president, French President Emmanuel Macron, after Sunday's bruising loss to Marine Le Pen's national rally in EU elections, is a risky move that opens the possibility of the extreme right. The move was a shock, said Anne Muxel, the executive director of Sciences Po's Center of Political Sciences, adding that it left the country in an uncertain situation.
It's a play at risks because it opens the possibility that the extreme right arrives for the first time at the government. It opens the eventuality to have a cohabitation in France.
If the Eurosceptic anti-immigration national rally did score a majority, Macron would result remain president for three more years. South Korea's military says it is detecting signs that North Korea is installing its own loudspeakers along their border. This is a day after the South blared anti-Pyongyang propaganda broadcast over its speakers. South Korea's broadcast on Sunday was in retaliation for the North sending over 1,000 balloons filled with trash and manure over the last couple of weeks. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports a jury is now deliberating in the Hunter Biden federal gun case.
Jurors in Delaware have started deliberating whether the president's son is guilty of charges over a revolver he bought 6 years ago when prosecutors say he was addicted to crack. They claim he lied on a federal forum that he was not illegally using or addicted to drugs. In closing arguments, a prosecutor told jurors to focus on the overwhelming evidence against Hunter Biden and disregard the gallery, which included First Lady Jill Biden. Hunter Biden's lawyers have tried to show he did not consider himself an addict when he filled out the form. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Doctors Without Borders says the notorious Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group fighting Sudan's military for over a year fired shots and looted a main hospital in the western region of Darfur, forcing its closure. The RSF attacked the South Hospital in Al-Fashir, the capital city at North Darfur province, on Sunday, opening fire on medical staff and patients, the aid group said in a statement. Most patients and the medical team managed to flee the shooting. It was not immediately clear if there were casualties. This came as the RSF intensified its offensive. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Security Council passes a ceasefire resolution.
Today, this council sent a clear message to Hamas. Accept the ceasefire deal on the table.
Using high tech to up the game in the Korean balloon wars.
The aim is to drop cargoes deeper into North Korea, including over the capital, Pyongyang, with longer ranges now possible.
And the launch of Sing for Hope pianos.
I think it's a beautiful thing to bring people together through music.
Today is Tuesday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
It offers a glimmer of hope to the Palestinians.
Algerian UN Ambassador Omar Benjamma, after the Security Council backed a proposal outlined by U.S. President Joe Biden for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and urged the Palestinian militants to accept the deal aimed at ending the eight-month-long war.
We're waiting on Hamas to agree to the ceasefire deal it claims to want. But we cannot afford to wait and wait and wait. With every passing day, needless suffering continues.
U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfeld.
Israel has already agreed to this deal, and the fighting could stop today if Hamas would do the same.
Hamas responded by saying in a statement it welcomed the resolution and was ready to work with mediators in indirect negotiations with Israel to implement it. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the region trying to get the deal done. Details now in this report from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
If you want a ceasefire, press Hamas to say yes.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Monday shuttled between Cairo and Jerusalem, pushing a proposed truce in Gaza. Blinken first met with Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Afterward, he told reporters that the greatest obstacle in reaching a ceasefire was that Hamas had yet to accept the terms of a deal outlined by U.S. President Joe Biden last month.
The only party that's not said yes is Hamas. That's who everyone's waiting on. That's who the Palestinians in Gaza are waiting on. It's who the Israelis are waiting on. It's who the hostages and the hostage families are waiting on.
Blinken then flew to Israel, where he met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In a statement, Netanyahu said his country remained committed to total victory. A Hamas official told Reuters on Monday that Blinken's comments were biased toward Israel. The war has now entered its ninth month since Hamas-led fighters killed 1,200 people and took some 250 others hostage in a rampage through southern Israel. In response, Israel launched an assault on the Gaza Strip that has killed more than 37,000 Palestinians and reduced most of the enclave to wasteland. Israel's military on Monday released video it said showed scenes from a weekend operation that resulted in the rescue of four hostages kidnapped on October 7th and recovered from the Nusayrat refugee camp in the center of the Gaza Strip. Palestinian officials said the operation, which involved airstrikes and ground troops, killed 274 people, making it one of the deadliest assaults of the war. Anas Alyan picked through the ruins of his home.
This is our house. We were safely sitting in it, and suddenly several consecutive explosions happened. We did not know what was happening. I was sitting upstairs in my apartment. I went down to my parents' floor and found all my relatives thrown out because of the Jewish soldiers. They were firing at us with mortar rockets at the living room. All my relatives were wounded. There was a lot of gunfire. F-16, quadcopters, drones. It was horrible. Soldiers in this area were all firing.
Israeli forces said they were aware of under 100 Palestinians killed and did not know how many were combatants. Hamas's military wing released this video on Sunday, purporting to show its fighters battling Israeli tanks in the streets of Rafah in southern Gaza. Israeli forces began an operation in the city last month, despite White House pressure to hold off. Around half of the Gaza Strip's 2.3 million people had been sheltering in Rafah before last month's assault, and a million have had to flee again.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. So let's dig into this. Joining us now is Sri Makdisi, an English professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. His most recent book is Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial. Let's just start big picture with the resolution itself that the United States put forth in the Security Council. Sort of a bit of a turn for the United States in this matter, no?
I mean, it's not really new in that sense, in the sense that the United States is putting pressure on Hamas rather than on the Israelis. And so the resolution, which, by the way, is incredibly vague as to what's actually being asked of anybody, you know, because there's no specific plan for a ceasefire. But the point is that the resolution purports to put the ball in the net of Hamas, whereas in fact it's the Israelis who are consistently saying that they refuse to cease fire, and and Netanyahu has said that repeatedly. There will be no ceasefire until we've eliminated Hamas, to use his terms. Whereas Hamas has repeatedly expressed its willingness, in fact, its demand really is for there to be a permanent ceasefire. So that's the problem with the resolution. It's the problem with the way Biden formulated this so-called proposal. What it does, if I could elaborate, Scott, what it does is that it says there'll be an initial phase in which, you know, Hamas releases some of the prisoners that it holds under certain categories in return for a sort of temporary cessation of fire. But then beyond that, it's very, very fuzzy as to what happens next, and it sort of opens the door for something that the Israelis have historically taken delight in, which is a perpetual deferral of the next stage things through endless negotiation. I mean, they did that for the 20, 25 years of the so-called peace process. That's what the Israelis did. They continued to defer and to defer and to defer a meaningful resolution of the conflict, while in the meantime, continuing, in the case of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, continuing to implant new settlements and expand existing settlements and so forth, while claiming to negotiate. And that's, I mean, I'm sure they would like nothing more than perpetual negotiation in this case too, whereas what is urgently needed, given the situation on the ground, is first of all a permanent ceasefire, and secondly, obviously, the reconstruction of Gaza and urgent humanitarian aid. I mean, remember, the other context here is that the International Court of Justice has instructed the Israelis to open the crossings to allow aid to flow into Gaza, and it's not doing that. It's absolutely in violation of the International Court of Justice ruling, and it's also been instructed by the ICJ to stop its Operation Rafah, which it also is refusing to do. So that's what the focus needs to be, on the Israelis, in other words, not on Hamas. That's the irony of the U.S. resolution, which makes it, again, typical rather than exceptional.
Well, that's sort of how we got to where we are today, right? It is the never-ending delay. I mean, you could say they've been delaying since 1947,
the creation
of a state of Palestine.
Of a Palestinian state, yeah, of course. Yeah, and but especially, obviously, during the so-called peace process, and I say so-called because what it ended up being was a series of deferrals rather than actually, you know, resolutions of any kind, while in the meantime, you know, the Israelis, to use their parlance, continued to establish what they call facts on the ground, meaning new settlements and expansion of existing settlements and so on and so on. So, the problem, though, is that the U.S. talks as though it has no leverage over the Israelis. Like, we wish they would not kill so many civilians. We wish they wouldn't be quite so destructive. We wish they would allow humanitarian supplies in. All the while, you know, President Biden and Blinken and the rest of them are sort of wringing their hands as though there's nothing they can do, whereas, of course, there is something they can do, which is to shut off the supply of arms and weapons and bombs to the Israelis. That would certainly bring them to heel very, very quickly. But, you know, so there's this hand-wringing, which is gestural, which is kind of meaningless. And this Security Council resolution is basically more of the same in that sense. It's like, you know, enunciated hand-wringing rather than something, definitive to bring an end to this horrendous suffering.
Technically, aren't all UN resolutions figurative anyway?
No, because UN Security Council resolutions are binding. And the other thing that's really important here, and again, it gets lost in the endless verbiage, especially in Washington, which is that the Israelis, no matter what they say, according to international law, including the UN Security Council, including the World Court and so forth, is still the occupying power in Gaza, which means that it is it is responsible for the welfare of the human population in Gaza, which is incredibly ironic considering what it's doing to the population of Gaza at this point.
What happens, do you think? I mean, Hamas said they welcome the resolution. They're going to the negotiating table. But your gut reality, what happens?
My gut reality is that we're going to go on as we've been. The Israelis are going to go on bombing and starving. Hamas is going to go on fighting, and nothing's really going to change, because what will bring about change is the United States, in the form of President Biden, telling the Israelis, enough is enough. You've done enough harm. Stop it. Because everything the Israelis are doing, they depend on our weapons, our finance, our backing, our political capital, our support in the UN. They couldn't do anything without our support. So in that sense, we, as the United States, are complicit in what the Israelis are doing. And again, that's why, to go back to the hand-wringing, if you're supplying weapons and the bombs to this country, you can't wring your hands about they're not complying with international law. It's absurd.
What's happening in Europe, do you think that has any hope for influencing what happens in the midterm? It's not going to happen before the election, right? The politics is too much for the United States to do any shift, I would think.
I think Europe still, strangely enough, I mean, it's not across the board, mind you. It's different in different European, for different European countries. Europe still, in general, certainly the EU and NATO and so on, still look to the U.S. for leadership. But individual European countries have, you know, they're breaking ranks with the U.S. now. You know, Spain and Norway and some other countries have now recognized the existence of a Palestinian state. Spain, I think, has signed on to the genocide case that South Africa has brought at the International Court of Justice. So part of what this tells us is that the U.S. is not only now up to its eyeballs in complicity in genocide, because we supply the weapons and the political backing and so forth, but also the U.S. is squandering its own global hegemony in pursuit of Netanyahu's impulse in this war. In other words, if insofar as the U.S. once used to exert hegemony in Europe by cajoling European countries to kind of follow our lead, European countries are now looking at us and saying, well, we don't want to follow your lead because you've somehow lost the plot here. You've gone off in a different direction, and we no longer want to follow you. So I think it's also very important for people who are concerned with America's role, with America's visibility, with America's prestige, with America's political capital and diplomatic capital. We're squandering all those things in this. I think personally, this is me personally speaking, I think it's a criminal effort to continue supporting genocide. And it's criminal because genocide is a criminal act. And again, the legal statutes are very, very clear as to what's involved in genocide and the duty. It's not just if you want to, it's an obligation on the part of other states when they see a genocide taking place to intervene to stop the genocide. That's what South Africa did. That's what all the countries that have signed on to the South African case at the ICJ have done. They've all said, enough is enough. This has got to stop. The U.S. needs to be part of that at this point, although it's too little too late, I think.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure.
Suri Makdisi, an English professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. Following these other stories from around the world, a California administrative judge has rejected Tesla's bid to dismiss claims by a top state regulator accusing it of overstating its vehicle's self-driving capabilities. Haiti's new prime minister on Monday condemned the gang killings of three police officers on a patrol in a part of the capital controlled by gang leader Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier. A group of armed men working under Cherizier ambushed the patrol, which was from the police's anti-gang unit. An Italian subsidiary of French luxury giant LVMH that makes Dior-branded handbags was placed under court administration on Monday after a probe alleged it had subcontracted work to Chinese-owned firms that mistreated workers. In our our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump is back on the campaign trail following his convictions in New York for falsifying business records. At rallies in the western United States, Trump focused on immigration and threatened to sanction countries, including China, if they do not stop people from leaving for the United States. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Donald Trump returned to the presidential campaign trail last week in Arizona, where he said President Joe Biden has lost control of the U.S.-Mexican border.
It's all unsustainable. But the Biden invasion is no accident. It's a deliberate demolition of our sovereignty and of our borders. Somehow, somebody's going to explain to us why they would want this to happen. I guess it's probably votes.
There is no evidence that non-citizens are voting in significant numbers in U.S. elections. Trump was asked how he'll stop illegal migration and said he'll act against foreign governments that feed it.
If China or some other country is behaving badly, we have things called tariffs that are so severe.
The Biden administration this month moved to block asylum claims at the Mexican border when arrests for illegal crossings exceed 2,500 a day. Biden says necessary immigration reform need not come with the inflammatory remarks that Trump directs toward migrants.
While we fight for comprehensive immigration reform, he calls immigrants rapists and murderers. He says they are not people. They are not people. He says immigrants are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country. Folks, my predecessor wants a country just for some of us. We want a country for all of us.
Biden says Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric is out of line with founding American principles.
We represent how we are as a nation of immigrants, nation of dreamers, nation of freedom. And that's the America we share.
Trump's rallies last week were his first since being convicted of falsifying business records to hide so-called hush money payments he made ahead of the 2016 election. He told a rally in Nevada that his trial was the result of Biden weaponizing the judicial system while failing at the border.
This is the worst border in the history of the world. There's never been. No third world country has a border like that. And no third, I'll tell you what, no third world country has weaponization where they go after political candidates like we have either.
Associated Press polling in March showed shifting voter attitudes on immigration, with nearly a third of Americans now saying it is a major risk that immigrants will commit crimes. That's up from 19% who thought that in 2017. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
In the balloon war between North Korea and South Korean activists, one Seoul-based group has honed its tech expertise to develop balloons capable of dispensing leaflets and electronic speakers hundreds of kilometers across the border. More now on this from VOA's Joe Ramsey.
Built using 3D printers and components sourced online and sometimes equipped with GPS tracking, these so-called smart balloons can cost up to $1,000 each. Once or twice a month from spring to autumn, when favorable winds blow north, the secretive group flies the balloons, mostly under the cover of darkness. The aim is to drop cargoes deeper into North Korea, including over the capital, Pyongyang, with longer ranges now possible. One balloon has flown as far as China. Quote, our smart balloons are expensive, but we think they're 100 times more powerful than balloons flown by other groups, said one member of the group, which is called the Committee for Reform and Opening of Joseon. Joseon is another word for North Korea. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Malawi's vice president and nine others are missing after their plane disappeared from radar in a mountainous area of the country. Here's Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll.
Vice President Saulos Klaus Chilima was aboard a Malawi Defense Force aircraft that left the capital at 9:17 a.m. local time, and that all efforts to contact the aircraft since it disappeared from radar had so far failed. Search and rescue operations are ongoing. According to the statement, the aircraft had been scheduled to land at Mizuzu International Airport shortly after 10 a.m.
Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll. Apple unveiled on Monday its AI technology. They're calling it Apple Intelligence, which will be integrated across a suite of apps as it aims to become the face of generative AI for consumers and gain an edge over rival Microsoft. In the Apple demo presentation, they say it'll join with existing apps already on your Apple devices.
So you can say things like, pull up the files that Jaws shared with me last week, or show me all the photos of Mom, Olivia, and me, or play the podcast that my wife sent the other day.
Apple also said by using its own chips for cloud services, Apple can roll out advanced AI features that devices cannot handle alone without requiring expensive processors from NVIDIA. The approach also retains many of Apple's privacy and security features that are baked into the design of its in-house chips. And finally, people from all walks of life played colorful pianos at New York's Fosun Plaza in downtown Manhattan on Monday at a launch event for the Sing for Hope pianos.
Sing for Hope exists to create a better world through the arts. And this is one way of doing it, through these Sing for Hope pianos. Each one is done by a different visual artist and will go out to live for 3 weeks in various locations throughout New York City, everywhere from Little Island to Christopher Street Park, locations all over the city, which you can find on singforhope.org.
So basically, think of these pianos. They're wood. They're painted in vibrant colors and designs. And they're just out on the street or in the park, and people can sit down and play them. And at this debut event, a lot of them did.
Honestly, I love the event. It's very nice. A lot of different people, different colors, different ages. It's a very nice community. And just from my love for music, I enjoy it. As I'm also just a person that enjoys using the piano just to express myself. And I think a lot of other people here do the same thing.
It feels both relaxing and exhilarating because it's exciting, but at the same time, there's such a calming thing about piano music. And, you know, I'm excited also that it's a beautiful day. I always get concerned with outdoor things. Is it going to rain? So this is just, can't get better weather than this.
It feels different, I guess, because, like, normally I wouldn't play in front of people. It feels good. It feels, like, out of my comfort zone.
It feels good to, like, hear other people play different styles, classical, R&B, jazz, funk, all styles.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply troubled by the continued arrests of members of Azerbaijani civil society, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. He commented at a press briefing after being questioned about the arrest of prominent Azerbaijani economic analyst and journalist Farid Miralizadeh. Miralizadeh was detained by police on May 31st in connection with the government's spurious case against the independent anti-corruption news outlet Absas Media. Since November, a half dozen journalists from Absas Media have been detained by authorities. Other journalists, including several from the online TV channel Toplum, were arrested earlier this year in a renewed campaign of repression in Azerbaijan targeting independent voices, especially those exposing government corruption. Ironically, both Absas Media, which now operates from outside Azerbaijan, and Farid Miralizadeh say say he was not employed by Absas Media, but was one of hundreds of experts contacted by the outlet. In the U.S. State Department's most recent human rights report, among significant human rights abuses in Azerbaijan, it lists serious restrictions on freedom of expression and media freedom, including violence against journalists, unjustified arrests or prosecution of journalists, and enforcement of criminal defamation laws to limit expression. State Department spokesperson Miller said, "Those who exercise their fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, should not face arrest for doing so. We continue to urge the Azerbaijani government," he declared, "to immediately release all individuals who are unjustly detained and to respect the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all."
That was an editorial reflecting